2.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, January 14th, 2003. Palestine in Iraq, Palestine in Saudi Arabia. This isn't as strange as it seems. GAMLA, an organization of Israeli military and settlers, proposes this in a six-part article, The Logistics of Transfer, published July 3, 2002. And on the ground, the Israeli military, are they subduing the Palestinians, subjugating the Palestinians, or setting the stage for transfer? Zionism Unmasked, The Meaning and Logistics of Transfer. That is Taking Aim for today, January 14th. Ralph?
Maya, GAMLA is an organization of high-level military officers across the board in the Israeli armed forces, intelligence services. They're strategically placed. They are not a marginal group. They are not merely tied to the settler population, but they're tied to their supporters in the United States, within the establishment, within the ruling class structures that are reflected in JINSA, the American Enterprise Institute, the Wolfowitz, Pearl, Armitage group that has brought us 9/11. GAMLA is a reflection of the logic of Zionist policy in Palestine, the removal of the Palestinian people from history, the eradication of their identity as a people, as they were described from the inception by Theodor Herzl and Chaim Weizmann, as a people too many, with the formula, a land without a people for a people without a land. They were targeted for removal and for elimination, much as the Native American population had been in the United States. And every major spokesperson of the Zionist movement from its inception in the 1880s, 1870s, and 1880s to the present day, whether Labor Zionist or Likud or Revisionist Zionist, have reflected the intention of removing the Palestinians from any organized existence. Whatever the formulas of co-option of the moment, the logic of transfer is a leitmotif that has run through the practice and theory of Israeli policy and that of the Zionist movement.
By transfer, we mean the expulsion of the Palestinian people from their homeland. The Palestinian struggle has been for self-determination. It's a very long struggle that dates back to when Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire, and there was a national liberation movement throughout the Arab East. Now, what GAMLA does is, first of all, it sets the definitions, and the definition of pre-67 Israel, the Israel that was part of the partition and then the further occupation of land leading to the formation of the state in 48, the partition over the heads of the Palestinians by the United Nations. Now, what GAMLA does is it calls pre-67 Israel Western Eretz Yisrael, and then refers to the West Bank and Gaza as the eastern section of it. And what it states unequivocally is that as a first step would be to annex the West Bank and Gaza in the same way that Israel, the Zionist state of Israel, annexed the Golan Heights from Syria. GAMLA's logic is that the West Bank and Gaza were won through a war, that these are not occupied territories, but these are lands that were gained in what was an Israeli victory. Now, they also, in terms of defining the terms, they accept the Jordan as Palestine. And so they refer to the creation of a second Palestinian state, the first, quote, the first one being Jordan. And they state, quote, These ideas for the creation of a state that is in Iraq or Saudi Arabia derive from America's intention to dismantle Saddam Hussein's regime as well as Saudi Arabia's recently proposed peace plan. Iraq was once already suggested for this role in 1930, Gamla remarks. And it follows through with what we've discussed on other Taking Aim shows. For the fragmentation of Iraq, as Ralph has talked about in the Hidden History of Zionism, and as Israel Shahak documented with his translation of the Odidinom plan for the fragmentation of the Middle East, that Iraq would be divided into several autonomous regions, such as for the Kurds, or for the Turkmens, and for the other ethnic divisions within Iraq. And in that process, Gamla says, this is the time to set up an autonomous region for the Palestinian Arabs, that region being the desert area in the western part of Iraq. Ralph?
Maya, this project has its origins in the formation of the Zionist movement itself, and I think Gamla has to be given the credit of rooting itself in the real nature, theoretical and practical political activity of the Zionist movement from its inception, because it was upper bourgeois layers of the Jewish populations of Eastern Europe and of Central Europe who formulated the plan of Zionism for the removal of the Jews from Europe, and as a consequence they made common cause with the most anti-Semitic and retrograde regimes of the day. Both Theodor Herzl and Chaim Weizmann made an alliance with the authors of the great pogroms, Count von Plehve, the creator of the pogrom at Kishinev, and with the Tsar, and the formulation of land without a people for a people without a land was based upon their proposal to the Tsar's anti-Semitic ministers that they would remove what they called Europe's insurgent and subversive anarcho-Bolshevik Jews if they were funded and sponsored by the Tsar. And they made the same approach, which by the way was a successful approach both with the Tsar's ministers, they made the same approach to French imperialism, to British imperialism, to Mussolini, who funded the Zionist youth movement called Beitar, and ultimately to the German Reich itself, from whom they obtained substantial support, bringing Eichmann to Palestine in the 30s and Baron von Mildenstein, the head of the SS, a long-standing alliance between the Zionist leadership and the anti-Semitic and reactionary imperial regimes of Europe. As Gamla states, the goal of Zionism was always the return of Jews to Zion and the creation there of an exclusively Jewish state. This goal has remained unchanged and is no less urgent today. Sharon's stated aim of drawing another million Jews to the Jewish state is completely in line with it. In reality, a Jewish state is very self-explanatory. It is a state for the Jews, ethnically homogenous, not unlike European countries, since Jews must have the same rights as, say, those in Finland or other countries to be ethnically exclusive in their own territory. And I should mention that the major spokespersons for all elements of Zionism, such as Joseph Weitz, the head of colonization of David Ben-Gurion's labor Zionist, stated in 1940, not one tribe, not one clan, not one village shall be left. And the map that was presented to the United Nations by Rabbi Fishman on behalf of the Jewish National Fund and the World Jewish Zionist Organization at the time that the United Nations was considering the partition of Palestine, the map was the same map that Theodor Herzl had published in Volume 2 of his diaries at the turn of the 20th century. And that map designated Eretz Israel as all of Palestine, all of Lebanon, one third of Syria, two thirds of Iraq, all of Arabia, Egypt up to the Nile, including Cairo, the southern tier of Turkey, all of what is now the Jordan or Transjordan, which was designated as Eretz Israel, the land of Israel.
It's a good thing you mentioned that, Ralph, because I have to correct myself about Gamla. When they refer to Western Eretz Israel, they are referring to the land that's west of the Jordan River, because Gamla considers, as you point out with the Rabbi Fishman map, that Eastern Eretz Israel, an intention for the future, is Jordan.
And this is not just ideological propaganda. It was the practice from the beginning of the Zionist colonization, the forced expulsion of Palestinians from their land and their massacre in their villages systematically. That's been the character and the thrust of colonization and settler colonialism in Palestine. It's instructive to point out that at the time of the partition of Palestine by the United Nations, the Zionists at that point, through ethnic cleansing, had become approximately between 29% and 31% of the population, and they had about actually no more than 3% of the land, some estimated at the time as 1%. And the United Nations awarded 55% of the most fertile land to the Zionist movement. And within 6 months, prior even to the formation formally of the State of Israel, through a series of massacres from one end of Palestine to the other, nearly 800,000 Palestinians were driven out through out of a population of 960,000 people. And now the Zionist colonizers found themselves in possession of something like 90% of the land of Palestine that had been awarded to them, and they proceeded to do the following. There were 485 towns and villages that were in their possession, actually 475. 385 were razed to the ground, reduced to rubble. The land confiscated from the remaining 90 in an orgy of ethnic cleansing and genocidal massacre from one end of Palestine to the other. After which, the land requirements and the regulations of the Jewish National Fund were formally adopted as that of the State of Israel, in which it is decreed that in order to have the right to own land, to work on land, to lease it, or to sharecrop it, you have to establish at least four generations of maternal Jewish descent. And as we have often stated, if in this country people were told that in order to have the right to live on land, to work it, or to live, or to sharecrop it, or to rent it, you had to show that you had no Jewish blood for at least four generations, everybody would understand the racist character of a state predicated upon such policies. It is at the heart of the Zionist project. An exclusive Jewish state in the land of the Palestinian people means that the 1 million surviving Arabs of Israel are not just scheduled for expulsion, but are designated as people without any rights to live or work in that state. That is at the heart of the nature of the Israeli state, as it was of the colonial settler states in other parts of the world, and there is no compatibility between any modicum of self-determination for the Palestinian people and a state of this nature.
Gamla, Ralph, as you say, is very explicit, because they say that any of the so-called plans for a Palestinian entity or a Palestinian state in Yesha, and by Yesha they refer to the West Bank and Gaza, or as the Zionists say, Judea-Samaria. Judea and Samaria are the two parts of the West Bank for Eretz Yisrael, and Gaza. They call it Yesha. They say, quote, it would be a ticking time bomb. Ticking time bomb if there were any of the so-called two-state solutions or two-entity Bantustan solutions, whether it is the concessions, the capitulation of the Sari Nuseiba Ami Ayalon plan, and Ami Ayalon is the former chief of Israel Shin Bet Security Service, and he was so during the reign of Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Barak. So you have both the both that of those regimes from 1996 to 2000, and he and Nusseibeh have come up with a two-state plan that demilitarization of the Palestinian state, the unequivocal recognition of Israel as a quote Jewish state, and the complete relinquishment of the Palestinian right of return, that is for the Palestinians who were expelled from the Zionist state of Israel. So even such a state, or the Abu Mazen plan, with Abu Mazen, the concession that he made, which is a continuation, basically, of the Oslo agreements, which calls for, in that case, some right of return of Palestinians, about 100,000 to 200,000, to the Zionist state.
Out of nearly 5 million people, wouldn't you point out, but
that even these are too much for Gamla, because what Gamla says is, again, that these would be a ticking time bomb, that you must have the purity of the Jewish state as a Jewish state. So they call for the transfer in one way or another, be it either by agreement once the U.S. has invaded and occupied Iraq, to carve off a portion of it, or to carve off, to dismantle Saudi Arabia and carve off a portion of Saudi Arabia, either through agreement or, they say, through affected transfer, which we will go into a little while later, because essentially that is what is taking place on the ground as we speak. In no matter what you call it, it is the setting the stage for the effective transfer of the Palestinians.
And this is the inexorable logic of the racist premise that a state must be the theocratic and ethnically pure construct of a conquering and colonializing people, which would never have been something that anybody who was supportive of self-determination could have embraced for South Africa or for Algeria. Nobody was saying to the people of Africa and South Africa that the predicate for the right of self-determination was the insurance of the security of an exclusively white state in Johannesburg and Cape Town and Pretoria. No one demanded of the Rhodesian, of the Zambian and Zimbabwe peoples that they had to secure first an exclusively colonial white state in Salisbury or in Lusaka to be entitled to a little Bantustan in its perimeter. No one was saying to the people of Algeria that the French, who had been there for 130 years, should have an exclusively colonial state of French European populace in Oran and in Algiers as a predicate for any modicum of so autonomy for the Algerian people. The alternative has never been a Bantustan alongside a dominating and exploiting imperial construct. The alternative is a land in which people have rights based on citizenship, not on ethnic affiliation or religious identity. That is such a basic democratic demand that it is indecent exceptionalism when it comes to the Israeli state marks those who espouse it as essentially calling for amnesty for Israel, and it's unrealistic. It's what C. Wright Mills once called crackpot realism, since Zionism and the nature of an exclusively Jewish state is not compatible with any Palestinian existence or presence. As Gamla says, two vitally important conditions for Israel's survival are eliminating the demographic threat to the Jewish character state from Israeli Arabs and guaranteeing Israel's permanent strategic military depth. For obvious reasons, the creation of a Palestinian state in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, known collectively as Yesha, which is popular among so-called enlightened circles, does not remotely achieve either one of these conditions. And very, very systematically and logically, Gamla demonstrates that the entire history of Zionism and of the Israeli state has been that of seeking the removal and elimination of an organized Palestinian presence. Because, as they say, the demographic threat which they mean that the Palestinian people have a higher birth rate than the Jews, the European Jews in particular of Israel. And therefore, a million Palestinians within the Green Line, the 1967 borders, will be inevitably a majority. So are they going to allow, when they are 51% of the population, they say, that Palestinians will have control over the Knesset or will change the name of the Israeli state? In other words, there is no compatibility between a colonial settler state and the elementary right of self-determination for people or their rights as citizens as opposed to their rights based on ethnicity. That is the racist and inherently repressive and genocidal character of the Israeli state. I say genocidal because they must remove the Palestinian people from their land, their social organization as a people, from history in order to sustain this kind of construct. We see in North America what was the logic for the Native Americans, their physical liquidation and their confinement, their remnant in reservations, which are thinly veiled concentration camps. Zionism leads inevitably to that.
We also see in history the destruction of the dispersal of the Armenian people throughout the world. And we used to talk about the Armenianization of the Palestinian
which
people.
Which is the formulation that Jabotinsky utilized with respect to what he called a people too many.
Now, what Gamla, in referring, Ralph, as you mentioned before, to the Israeli Arabs, that is the Palestinians who are Israeli citizens resident in pre-67 Israel, those who did not leave during the attacks against the Palestinian people. Now, what Gamla writes, quote, "Encouraging Israeli Arabs to relocate will be much more complicated than doing so among Yesha Arabs and refugees. Yet this must be done, because even on their own, Israeli Arabs constitute a demographic threat to the Jewish character of the state." Now, what they say is that it's hard to get them to accept the curtailment of their political rights, but Israel simply has no other choice, end quote. So what do they plan to do? Now, they say that Michael Kleiner, who's the parliamentary member from the Herut Party, suggests creating a law encouraging the resettlement of Palestinian Arabs out of Israel into the surrounding Arab countries. And one of the ways that they would do it is that for non-Jewish citizens to make it so that they have no ability to participate in Israeli political life. And they recently tried that by trying to make it such in Israel that Azmi Bashara and the Balad Party and also another Arab member of parliament to make it so that they couldn't run in the elections that are going to take place in Israel on January 28th. Now, the Israeli Supreme Court at this moment overruled that decision, but the attempts were made and the attempts will happen again.
In any event, it should be remembered that there can be no political party in Israel which does not accept the Jewish character of the state.
That's very true.
I can recall, as you will, Maya, how vividly we experienced this when we were in Nazareth, which is a city in the Galilee with a Arab majority, namely the Palestinian majority, the one of the few areas that was not formally expunged, and Ben-Gurion complaining bitterly after that, that the poet and mayor of Nazareth at the time led a meeting of Palestinians in the city of Nazareth, a national meeting at which they had to stand up, salute the Israeli flag, and sing the Hatikva. The Hatikva, the national anthem, for 2,000 years with strong Jewish hearts. The absurdity of Palestinian leadership, including those of the Communist Party of Raqqa, singing the anthem of Jewish exclusiveness and expulsion in celebration of a state that denies their very existence, enhances the our understanding of the total lack of realism in attempting to reconcile any form of self-determination or national self-expression or survival within a repressive apartheid state of this nature. The issue is this, that a state is not coextensive with a people. There's no necessary connection between Jews as citizens in a Palestinian secular democratic society and hegemony through exclusive colonial subjugation of the indigenous population. We want the democratization of the Zion, the de-Zionization of the state, a state that reflects every elementary 18th century democratic principle in which citizenship does not flow from ethnicity or religious identity.
Well, Gamla would disagree with you, Ralph. They would say, and this is their last option, and that is Israeli Arabs can be given one more option, according to Gamla's July 3rd extensive six-part document, Logistics of Transfer, and the part with information campaign among Israeli Arab states, that the last option for the Israeli Arabs would be, quote, to convert to Judaism if they prefer to stay put. And they refer to mass conversion of the non-Jewish population to Judaism in 120 B.C., that after subduing the Idumeans, Jonathan Hyrcanus gave them a choice, expulsion or conversion to Judaism, and over a million of them preferred to remain and were converted.
This is the era of tribal conquest celebrated in the in that tribal document, the Old Testament, in which peoples were enslaved, the women were raped, the male progeny were exterminated, and their land seized. That is the biblical rationale in which God is a real estate agent. This is yours, and this is yours, and this is yours, and so on. But what is absurd about this in particular, this rationale for naked imperial conquest and colonial subjugation, because Israel has always seen itself and presented itself and survived on the basis of its being an outpost of imperial domination of the native and indigenous peoples, the Arab masses of Western Asia, and the control over their vital resources, notably oil. But the absurdity of all of this is in that the European Jews, the Ashkenazi, as we've discussed and has been documented repeatedly, are for the most part descendants of the Khazar peoples of the Caucasus in the 8th and 9th century, who were a non-Semitic people who were converted to Judaism. And indeed, the Tay-Sachs disease is not to be found amongst European Jews, although it is to be found amongst Semitic peoples, whether they are Jews or Muslims or Christians. The absurdity of all of
this... Wait, the Tay-Sachs disease is among European Jews.
Yes, that's what it is. Yes, it is amongst European right. Jews, but it is absent from Semitic peoples. As Arthur Kessler and
Alfred
Lilienthal have documented thoroughly, the irony of it all is that European Jews, such as ourselves, are not Semitic peoples. They're not descended from the original inhabitants of the area. And for the most part, the indigenous Semitic or Jewish inhabitants of the area are a minority now, and not only that, but the Palestinians were people who, in most part, were converts to Islam. Islam was a proselytizing religion in the 5th and 6th century that converted peoples there who were Semitic and Jewish. In original origin, this whole absurdity of ethnic affiliation is compounded by the fact that those who are now claiming the exclusive right to Palestine have never had a historical connection to it, and those who do are written out of the entitlement to their self-determination, their land, or their attachment to it. That is the inherent racist and ahistorical and irrational logic of imperialism, which is a doctrine of conquest, and Zionism is nothing but an extension and presence of imperialism on the ground to torment and subjugate the peoples of that area.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today, Zionism Unmasked, The Meaning and Logistics of Transfer. Today is January 14th, 2002. You can reach us at our WBAI voicemail, 212-209-2953, or you can contact us at our email, takingaim@pacbell.net, or write to us at Post Office Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. We have many books and pamphlets that will be of interest to you, such as The Hidden History of Zionism and Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, as well as tapes and CDs of Taking Aim programs and the special programs that we prepare, including lectures. Now, the concept of transfer has been objected to and recognized by professors in Israel and here in the United States, who have prepared a document, a letter that they have been circulating, and to date more than 800 professors have signed it in the United States. And what they're warning about is the ethnic cleansing that is taking place right now on the ground in Israel, setting the stage for transfer. They point to the more than $10 million per day of American tax dollars that go to Israel, and it is more than $10 million a day. And they say that, as we refer to Michael Kleiner, and there's also the Israeli Member of Parliament, Benny Elon, and it was reported in the Yediot Aharonot website on September 19th, 2002, where they talked about the demographic problem of the Palestinian and that the solution would be transfer. Also, they point to the Chief of Staff, Moshe Yaalon, who described Palestinians as a, quote, cancerous manifestation, end quote, and equated the military actions in the occupied territories as chemotherapy, suggesting that more radical treatment may be necessary.
Maya, the Gamla document starts with Theodor Herzl when he says it is long past time to say that the Jews wish to transfer out all the Arabs, and they will do it. However it can be done and however it must be done, the strategy for transfer will be developed. Now, Theodor Herzl, the founder and the father of Zionism, is echoed by the annual national security poll conducted by the Jaffa Center for Strategic Studies of Tel Aviv University, which was this particular poll taken in February of 2002 and is cited in particular by Gamla. It was overseen by Professor Asha Aryan. 46% of Israeli Jews favored forced transfer of Palestinian Arabs out of Yesha, that is to say the West Bank and Gaza. When the question of transfer was posed generically, 60%, Gamla points out, of respondents were in favor of the removal of Israeli Arabs, that is to say, nominal citizens within the Green Line were to be expelled. 60% of respondents cited in favor of that outcome.
Now, you can read the Gamla documents, the July 3, 2002, six-part series at www.gamla.org.il, and then you look for the English articles of July 3rd. Now, in Israel, Anat Matar is the mother of Haggai Matar, who is one of the men in prison for refusing to serve in the Israeli military. Now, she made a speech on December 19th at a meeting in Tel Aviv, in which she elaborated what was going on in by the Israeli Defense Forces and the Israeli government, with the complicity of the Israelis who are serving in the military, not only in the West Bank and Gaza, the refuseniks, but also the military who serve throughout the IDF. And she said that quote, "Everyone who lends a hand to the IDF today is complicit in this move," end quote. And the move that she is talking about is the forced emigration of Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza. And she points to a survey that was done by the Institute of Community and Public Health at Birzeit University. And it showed in the survey that 50% of the schools in the Ramallah area reported a growing phenomenon of emigration. Emigration. Children dropping out of school because their families had emigrated. They could no longer accept the conditions in the West Bank.
And you see, Maya, one of the important points here about these constant polls that the Zionists take to show support within the Israeli population for the expulsion of the Palestinians is that there is never an alternative. The poll structures the demand around the alternative of permanent hostilities and permanent conflict or the removal of the Palestinians. When the alternative of a society in which there is no discrimination, in which rights of all are protected as citizens, is formulated, there's a very different response. And the democratic and secular formulation in which Zionism, which guarantees permanent war and permanent insecurity to the population, is unchallenged. That democratic and secular formulation, which does challenge this permanent insecurity and bloodshed, would win support. Were it formulated, were it presented, were it mobilized around, Ron HaCohen, who does a letter from Israel and is a professor of comparative literature at Tel Aviv University, has done an interesting piece called Ethnic Cleansing, Past, Present, and Future on January 1st, in which he discusses the reality on the ground of the preparations for transfer and how this has been the constant of Zionist practice. He makes an interesting point as well when he says there's a puzzling paradox about Holocaust denial. Those who deny it are precisely the ones who would have supported it. And indeed, what he does about the proto-fascists who deny that that Nazism and fascism targeted the Jews as a people for their liquidation and extermination, the counterpart to that is those who deny the reality of Israeli genocidal intent and massacre and expulsion of the Palestinian people. Those who deny it are precisely those who support it when it is occurring, as Ron HaCohen eloquently points out. He states, "The idea of transfer, the euphemism for ethnic cleansing and mass deportation, is discussed openly. Several political parties support it. Sharon's cabinet is in support of it. They speak of a voluntary transfer, but Minister Benny Elon is quite explicit about what they mean by voluntary. Quote, it's like a man who refuses to give his wife a divorce. According to Jewish law, this husband can be jailed and slashed until he complies. If you wonder why Israel is turning Palestinian life into a hell, this is not the futile war on terror is the answer," says Ron HaCohen. And he, describing the important role that Gamla, the group which he describes, former high-level military officers, offers a detailed plan for the forced expulsion of all Palestinians from the occupied territories. He states, even their timetable is too long. Ariel Sharon has ordered his forces to prepare to drive out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians on the day the United States conflict starts against Iraq. Sharon has rejected an official Jordanian request that Israel issue a public declaration opposing the transfer. And this is from an article in Haaretz on the 29th of November of last year.
Ralph, on Sunday, April 28th, that's, you know, many months ago, the Telegraph in Great Britain published an article by the Israeli
historian,
so-called historian,
but he's a military consultant and a high-level Mossad operative,
Martin von Creveld, in which he stated how this expulsion could take place with the U.S. invasion, an assault on Iraq. He says, first, Israel's three submarines would take up firing positions at seas. At sea, borders would be closed, a news blackout imposed, and all foreign journalists rounded up and confined to a hotel. A force of 12 divisions, 11 of them armored, plus various territorial units suitable for occupation duties would be deployed, 5 against Egypt, 3 against Syria, and 1 opposite Lebanon. Remember, many of the Israeli militarists have talked about a three-front war. Now, this would leave 3 to face east, as well as enough forces to put a tank inside every Arab-Israeli village, just in case their populations get, quote, any funny ideas. The expulsion of the Palestinians would require only a few brigades, von Creveld remarks. They would not drag people out of their houses, but use heavy artillery to drive them out. The damage caused to Jenin would look like a pinprick in comparison, and any outside intervention could be held off by the Israeli Air Force.
This is echoed in Gamla's plan. It's very instructive, I think, to note that what they describe is any attempts on the part of the Arabs to carry out militant activity must be immediately suppressed in the most brutal way, and I'm quoting. It is possible to implement the plan of Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz, an American liberal lawyer. It works as follows. Israel issues a warning that in response to any attack or resistance, she will immediately completely level Arab villages or settlements, randomly chosen by a computer. The essence of the idea is to make the Palestinians completely responsible for their own fate, and to make it clear that militancy will not merely be tolerated, but will be harshly punished. Along with the world, the Arabs will know precisely the result. The use of a computer to select the place of Israeli response will put them on notice. So it's a transparent call for the preparations on the ground, and the destruction of the West Bank and Gaza is precisely the predicate for this underlying intent to drive them out, to destroy their organized existence on the ground.
Well, in the short time remaining, let us look at some of the practice on the ground. In particular, look at the lottery. On December 17th, in the Palestine Chronicle, it was exposed by Awad El Rajoub in an article, Playing Toss, Israelis Force Palestinians to Choose Torture Methods. Quote, Israeli torture methods vary from breaking a right hand, a left hand, a head, a hand, and a leg. Both legs, a tooth, a nose, or simply a shot with a bullet. End quote. In his article from Hebron, he talks about the various torture schemes adopted by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinians, and he calls them a, quote, toss game, whereby they force Palestinians to choose their own type of torture. Now, he calls it a toss game, but the Washington Post coined it a lottery. And that is what we considered. It's a lottery. And they describe what happened to Youssef, a 22-year-old Palestinian who, living in Hebron, came across 4 Israeli soldiers. Quote, they held me at gunpoint, ordered me to take off my shirt, and searched me to the nose, he recalled. They dragged me 10 meters away and told me I have to choose my own torture through a toss by picking a paper out of 8 pieces of paper put in a small pot. I chose one of the 8. Now, he's choosing by random, and it was the hand-breaking phrase. One of the Israeli soldiers grabbed me while the other 3 others broke my right hand with the rear of their rifles. They beat me until I was unconscious, and I was taken to the hospital. Now, Youssef learned from other Palestinians that the same had happened to them. And the Palestinian Human Rights Society has been investigating this and has now realized that this is becoming a prevalent tactic. So the Washington Post on January 3rd, Friday, January 3rd, had an editorial. And they also talked about Amran Abu Hamidi, an 18-year-old high school student who also in Hebron was accosted by the Israeli troops, and the same thing happened to him. Or an 11, and they go and they discuss the grinding carnage, the calculated brutality. Now, these are the terms of the Washington Post, because obviously imperialism is concerned about the out-and-out brutal plans of Ariel Sharon and the what the plans of expulsion and this total subjugation can mean
well,
throughout
these
the
are,
Arab
East. These are crocodile tears, Maya, because while they wring their hands, they urge continued military support and military integration of the plans for the fragmentation of the Arab East with those of Sharon and the government's explicit intent to eliminate the Palestinian existence. The National Catholic Observer published a very vivid account of what is on the 11th of January of this year. The threat of mass expulsion adds to Palestinian woes. Curfew is now house arrest. People cannot leave their homes even to go across the street or into their gardens. Their plants and animals are dying. Their children cannot get medical attention or go to school. Their farmers cannot work in their fields to plant or care for or harvest their crops. People are shot for standing in open doorways. 24-hour curfews prevent the Muslim population, the vast majority, from going to mosque. Access to all hospitals is blocked. The children are no longer able to get any schooling. People cannot get to their jobs. Over 60% of the population is now unemployed. The vast majority are living at starvation level. The number of malnourished children is growing. The Israelis arrive in villages with hundreds of tanks. The houses are demolished and ransacked. The people are harassed and humiliated. The injuries and deaths by shooting are a daily event. The leadership class is systematically eliminated through targeted assassination. Bystanders are invariably killed. The ministry of any incipient Palestinian dependent state have been largely destroyed. The Palestinian Authority has now been rendered entirely non-functional. The entire population in the occupied territories is literally imprisoned in fragmented territories divided from each other by walls, trenches, checkpoints, shootings, and murder. This is the beginning of a report by the National Catholic Reporter. It is echoed by every objective presence on the ground. Mifta, in its report, The Dying Truth in Nablus, by Rula Sharkawi, gives an absolutely numbing account of the reality in that tormented city. The West Bank Palestinian Nablus does not make the news anymore, writes Rula Sharkawi on December 17th of last year. Once known for its vibrancy, its energy, and its generosity, its love for food and music, it is a ghost town. As says Soraya, she stands in the wreckage of what was her home in the ancient Kasbah. Now, the Kasbah, which was 1,000 years old, it's one of the oldest continuous residents in the region, is now, quote, a pile of rubble. It is completely destroyed by missiles, by tanks, by systematic devastation. It is the economy has all but collapsed. The education system has effectively been shut down. I'm quoting, the children whose lives as children have been stolen by occupation, the troubled psychological well-being of an entire population, the devastated infrastructure of community centers, homes, and businesses, and the greatest fatality hidden and masked from sight and sound is the truth that reflects the daily Palestinian reality and voices drowned and buried and discredited, what is not heard, what is not told of this collective punishment, of this destruction of homes, of this elimination of habitation wherever it is found, is the hidden intent of removal, the hidden plan to expel. This collective punishment of 200,000 Palestinians living in Nablus is the preparation for their removal from Nablus and from the West Bank.
Look at Tracy Wilkinson, a Los Angeles Times staff writer, an article she wrote on December 30th, 2002, Palestinian Towns Wobbling on Last Legs. Now, if you separate the facts of the article from the propaganda, in other words, her perspective on the Palestinian struggle for self-determination, you see a clear description of what Ralph is talking about eliminating the Palestinian presence. She talks about a village, Deir Istiya. Well, we've been speaking a great deal about the cities, the Ramallah, Jenin, Nablus. But look at some of these villages. Deir Istiya is 24 miles from Tel Aviv. It shows you the close range, the proximity of Palestinian towns and villages to pre-67 Israel. And 70% of the men in this village had worked in Israel. And many of them had also worked in Kuwait, where they were expelled after the first Gulf War. And what's happened is that they are now unemployed. The village, as she says, and villages across the West Bank are, quote, like this one, are dying a slow death. More than 2 years of closures, curfews, and the pressure of Israeli army tanks have ruined the livelihood, the economy, the agriculture, the education, and in some cases the health of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian men, women, and children. And what they are doing is that they're making Palestine into rubble and poverty.
Maya, the National Catholic Reporter's account gives an insight into what is the daily reality, not only in Nablus, but from Jalil to El Khalil, in every part of Palestine, including inside the Green Line. She talks about a boy named Mahmoud, to whom she spoke. He states, we were sitting on the sidewalk, Israeli tanks rolled in, and their guns pointed at us. We started to run. I ran ahead of Mahmoud. I turned around to check on him. I saw he had been hit. I ran back to help him. I was shot twice. I was caught off guard, and I said, "You were what?" "It's true. It's true." Zaid lifts up his shirt for me to examine the evidence. One bullet wound on each side of his abdomen. 6-inch scar in the center with fresh stitch marks along its side. And then, as the article continues, the weight of personal loss, death, and life under oppressive military rule is something that children should not have to bear. Zaid is 11. Mahmoud was 8. This is the daily reality of the destruction of the Palestinian people. And the mother stated, "Where is the world's eye while we are dying?" Last week, a 3-year-old boy was shot in front of me by the army. Before that, a 20-year-old woman was crushed to death by Israeli tanks. A few days ago, Rami Al-Fakha, an 8-year-old, died instantly when the soldiers shot him in the heart. We are dying here all the time. No one sees us. No one asks about us. Where is the world, I ask you? Where?
On December 27th, the Israeli army told to turn up the heat is an article from iAfrica.com. And the Israeli government ordered the army to, quote, turn up the heat on the Palestinians. And Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz commanded the military to, quote, step up the pressure and act with all the force required against the Palestinians wherever they are. And he calls, Palestinian militants are terrorists. Then this is what the Defense Ministry issued on Friday, December 27th. Turn up the heat, step up the pressure. This includes torture, using Palestinians as human shields, targeted assassinations. There have been 80 in the past 2 years. Also, administrative detentions. That is, there are 1,000 Palestinians who have been rounded up, no charges, put away for 6 months with, again, renewals for 6 months by military commanders. On and on, as Ralph has said, demolitions, leveling Jenin, leveling Nablus. But also, if you look at the Washington Post, December 8th, 2002, an article by Molly Moore, which is available on the internet. On remote hilltops, Israelis broaden the settlements. Now, we don't have time to go into it, but if you look at the outposts that are now constructed throughout the West Bank, 66 new Jewish outposts have been documented by Peace Now. Two-thirds were established in the past 11 months, the most intense period of the conflict, according to Molly Moore, reporting about Peace Now.
And the Amnesty International report called Israel and the Occupied Territories Shielded from Scrutiny begins as follows. I have been in urban environments where house-to-house fighting occurred, in Rwanda, in Nicaragua, in El Salvador, in Colombia, in cities struck by massive earthquakes such as Mexico City. The devastation in the Palestinian camps is the worst elements of all these situations. The houses are not just bulldozed or dynamite, they are reduced to dust by repeated and deliberate coming and goings of bulldozers and tanks. Houses are being pierced from wall to wall by tanks and helicopter gunships. Houses are being cut down the middle as if by giant scissors. Inside, an eerie vision of dining or bedrooms almost intact. No signs whatever that these dining rooms or bedrooms had been used. Gratuitous, wanton, unnecessary destruction. Children's prams, toys, beds everywhere. Where are these children? We don't know. We do know where the survivors will be in the future. Unquote. Not in Palestine, is the conclusion.
Zionism unmasked. The meaning and logistics of transfer. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll be with you next week. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or at takingaim@pacbell.net.
And Taking Aim will return next Tuesday at 5 p.m. This is 99.5, commercial-free, listener-supported Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York City.